Welcome behind the news. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and the usual two segments for today's show. First, in a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Tyson Slocum and David Arkush. They're both with Public Citizen, and they're following various aspects of the financial re-regulation schemes, or regulation schemes, or appearance of financial regulation schemes that are working their way through Congress. It's all rather complex, arcane, and the details are sometimes far worse than the headlines. So we'll get their view on what is going on behind the scenes with all that. Still in process, so it's an evolving story. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Monty Neal, who is a longstanding progressive educator, director of something called Fair Test, about what's going on with the Obama administration's proposals for public school reform. There's a race to the top scheme that the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, is promoting. Surprisingly, it looks an awful lot like what the Bush administration was into, testing and charter schools and all that stuff. So we'll hear from Monty Neal on what that's all about and what might be a better way to go about all that. Okay, let me interrupt that introduction with a meta introduction. Hello again, KPFA and podcast listeners. It's been a while since I produced a new show. WBAI, where this show originates, was fundraising for the last several weeks, and I was mostly preempted. But now I'm back, at least until the next endless round of fundraising begins again. Now, the usual words in the economic news. In general, we continue to see signs of stabilization, but no serious signs of a turnaround. I suppose that coming after such a deep recession, a period of feat-finding can be expected, but it's still a long way from even an overture to anything resembling prosperity. And since there have been essentially no structural reforms of the U.S. economy, or even a serious discussion of same, I'm wondering if anything resembling prosperity is in our near future. I don't know how many of you heard my review of the U.S. employment report for October, so I'll do a quick reprise before moving on. On November 6th, we got the numbers on what happened to the job market in October. Once again, less bad is what passes for good news these days. The headline job loss was the best, meaning the smallest loss we've gotten in more than a year. But below that surface, things look pretty crummy. Employers shed 190,000 jobs in October. Over the last 3 months, job losses have averaged 188,000 a month, a sharp contrast with the 691,000 average in the first 3 months of the year. Sharp-eared listeners may notice that 188,000 average is lower than 190,000 in October. But the reason for this is that the previous months were revised downwards. Losses were originally reported as higher, and they were revised downward. So this 190,000 is the best initial report we've gotten in a year. Still, the October number is a long way from good. It's at the 13th percentile of monthly job changes in 1948, meaning that 87% of the months over the last 60-plus years were better than what we just experienced. Though losses were widespread across industrial sectors, they were concentrated in goods production, meaning manufacturing and construction. But most service sectors took a hit, too. One encouraging feature was a substantial gain in temp employment. That's often been a portent of broader job gains, though a lot of the old historical norms haven't been working as well as they used to. The composition of construction losses is interesting. Residential accounted for less than a quarter of the loss, and non-residential over three-quarters. This suggests that the commercial real estate bust is taking center stage. We've already got too many malls, warehouses, and office buildings, and the last thing we need to do is build more of them. But heavy and civil construction also showed losses. Where is all that stimulus money going? More on this in a moment. Those figures come from a survey of employers. The companion survey of households painted a darker picture. The share of the population working fell hard for the month to its lowest level in 26 years. As I've been saying here for months, all the employment gains of the 1980s and 1990s have been undone by the two recessions we've been through this decade, with little intervening help from the weakest expansion of the modern era, the one that ran from 2002 to 2007. This sort of unraveling has no precedent in anything we've seen since the 1930s. The unemployment rate rose a stiff 0.4 point to 10.2%, its highest level in 26 years. and I should say that 26 years ago was the year of recovery from the deep slump of the early 1980s. The unemployment rate is now just 6/10 of a point away from its post-World War II record of 10.8, set in late 1982. The broadest measure of unemployment, the so-called U6 rate, which adds those working part-time even though they'd like full-time work, and those who've dropped out of the labor force because they have concluded the job search is hopeless, two groups of people who are excluded from the headline unemployment rate, that rose a half a point to 17.5%, which is a terrible number. Not only is the unemployment rate very high, the composition of the jobless is sad to contemplate. The average length of unemployment rose again to set another all-time record. The duration of joblessness always rises in recessions, but this one is in a league all by itself. Among the unemployed, the share of permanent job losers, as opposed to those on temporary layoff or those just entering or re-entering the workforce, is at a record high level. And it looks like the probability of finding a job is at an all-time low in 60 years of data. As I pointed out before, what distinguishes this recession from the earlier ones isn't so much the rate of job loss, it's the reluctance of employers to hire at all. All in all, it looks to me like we're well into a transition from a terrifying rate of economic decline and associated job loss to something approaching stability. But that's not enough to generate employment gains. It could be mid-2010 before we start seeing those. And now a few words on the stimulus package. I'll have more to say about all this in a few weeks, since I'm reserving the details for an article from my newsletter, Left Business Observer, but I'll just say a couple of quick things for now. One is that spending so far is quite small. About 1% of GDP has actually been disbursed and received. By contrast, the WPA during the 1930s spent about twice that much, and in the process built thousands of schools, rebuilt thousands of hospitals, repaved 280,000 miles of road, and so on. No one is even talking about anything like that now, as badly as it's needed. And two, the distribution of the stimulus spending by state is kind of amazing. Towards the top of the list, measured against total income of the state, are small places like Alaska, North Dakota, Montana, and South Dakota. Toward the bottom, a lot of big ones, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut among them. California just missed making the bottom 10. Fascinating how Washington redistributes money away from states that are more liberal towards those that are more conservative and most likely to rail against Washington. Can't we just cut them off? Okay, a musical break, and we'll be back to talk financial regulation. And that was some of the Piano Sonata No. 29, the first movement by Joseph Haydn, performed by the Hungarian pianist, and I hope I'm not brutalizing the name too much, Jino Jandó, from his collection of the complete Piano Sonatas of Haydn, which is a glorious and wonderful thing, something I only recently discovered, and quite beautiful, I've got to say. Okay, we're joined now on the line by David Arkush, who's with Public Citizen in D.C. We're trying to get his colleague Tyson Slocum on the line as well. Welcome, David.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. So Tyson has been following the derivatives regulation, but you've been following some of the other stories on what's going on. Congress is contemplating. So what's it look like? There's been a lot of talk about taking some power away from the Federal Reserve. What else is happening on the ground with financial re-regulation or regulation or whatever you want to call it?
Gosh, there's a lot of pieces in place. So there's, one of the big ones is the creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Agency that would regulate consumer financial credit, lending products or other financial products. So this is credit cards, mortgages, bank accounts, those types of things. That's really one of the biggest pieces. There's regulation of hedge funds and private equity, the derivatives market, as you mentioned, trying to restore a little bit of independence and some accountability to the credit rating agencies, some corporate governance reforms, some investor protection reforms. There's really a huge amount that's going on. You know, Senator Dodd released his draft legislation earlier this week, and it was over 1,100 pages. And it's not because they're bad at editing. It's because there's a whole lot in there. They're taking on a lot all at once.
Okay, let's do these piece by piece and get a feel for what's happening. First of all, with this Consumer Protection Agency, which is extremely controversial, the industry hates the idea with a passion, and they've been certainly deploying a lot of lobbyists to make their point. What's the scope of what's being contemplated, and what do you think is the likelihood of any of it actually happening?
You know, it's interesting. Capitol Hill is about the only place in the world this could be controversial, and it's because of the influence of the banking lobbyists. You know, this is actually wildly popular with the public. It's sort of ridiculous that what we've got right now is consumer protection regulations split up among 7 different federal agencies, overseeing 20 different statutes, and there's sort of gaps in the authority and conflicts. And if you don't like what one agency is doing to regulate you, you can run to another one, just change your charter and find yourself a new regulator.
This is chaos. Specifically about financials.
That's right, for financial products, right. And so what this would do is you know, really make some sense out of this system. You get one federal agency that's focused on protecting consumers in the context of financial products. That's its, you know, sole mission, so it's not, you know, distracted by other things. It can, you know, make for much more efficient, you know, regulation and consistency and build up some real expertise in this agency to make sure that consumers are protected. Now, what this would do is cover, all consumer financial products unless they're specifically exempted, and that's sort of one of the things that's at issue, is there are some exemptions on the table. But so we're talking again about your credit card, your bank account, this would cover mortgages, payday loans, tax refund anticipation loans, all those types of things. And the agency would have authority to make rules establishing, standards for what's permissible, declaring certain types of, products or terms unfair or deceptive, and it would have the authority to enforce its new regulations.
Are there any segments of business aside from the financial sector that would be opposed to this kind of regulation, or is this just really a narrow financial concern?
Well, what every business says is they're all for consumer protection, they're all for this agency, just don't include them.
Yes, so, of course.
So everybody wants out, right? So credit insurance, they're fighting for an exemption, and they got a bit of an exemption in the House, the bill as it currently stands. Real estate agents want to be excluded. Auto dealers want to be excluded, even when they're lending. You know, even when they're in the business of making loans, which is precisely what's covered by this agency. In the House, they got an exemption. In the Senate, the draft that Senator Dodd introduced, there is not the same auto exemption. So that's quite an improvement. Auto dealers, I mean, some of the lending there, some of the worst practices that go on in terms of financial lending, it's really unacceptable to exclude them.
Dodd has proposed in the Senate, Christopher Dodd has proposed reducing the power of the Federal Reserve and consolidating a lot of regulatory agencies into basically a single larger one. Tell us about the outlines of that legislation, and what do you think the prospects of that are?
Well, so as you said, the bill would consolidate all of federal banking into one agency. So this means taking away some of the Fed's banking supervision, taking away some of the FDICs, and then combining the OCC and the OTS. And so you have sort of one federal banking charter, one federal banking regulator. What's interesting about that issue is you're seeing, people are sort of all over the place on it. You've got, J.P. Morgan Chase says it actually sounds like a pretty good idea, and it's about time. Wells Fargo says they think it's a horrible idea. And these are two large banks.
Now, is this a genuine difference of philosophy, or does this have something to do with the structure of their businesses?
I haven't actually been able to discern, whether it's what the cause of that difference would be. I think that, and in fact, I don't have an opinion on it. I think much more important I think it's intriguing. I think one good aspect of it would be to cut down on regulator shopping. You've actually had this problem with banks being able to just change their charter and then change who they're regulated by.
Yeah, let's expand on that point a moment because that's kind of arcane, I think, to the general public. A lot of financial enterprises have been able to structure themselves and incorporate themselves so that they get to choose the most lax regulator. Isn't that the case?
That's absolutely right. And if they're facing an enforcement an investigation or enforcement effort by one regulator, they can actually just change their charter, right? So change from a federal bank to a federal thrift.
Yeah, AIG did that somehow. They got regulated as a thrift, didn't they?
I believe that's right.
Yeah, it was just surreal.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's sort of ridiculous if you can get away. I mean, imagine the equivalent. You've got a bank robber or something can just. You know, the police finally catch up with the person, and he just says, "Oh, I'm just changing myself to. I'm not a bank robber. I'm a thrift robber."
Right.
And then you know.
And I want to pick my judge too, and I'll pick the jury while I'm at it as well.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think we have your colleague Tyson Slocum on the line now too. Are you here, Tyson?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Welcome to Behind the News. So an important part of all this is what you've been following, the derivatives regulation. Some of the stuff sounds pretty good on the surface, but is it really that good when you peel away the surface?
Well, with first, it's really important to note that the House legislation was a huge disappointment. We've got to understand that the roots of this financial crisis was the unregulated derivative market. And the legislation that was cobbled together by Barney Frank's committee provided far too many loopholes to allow banks and other institutions to preserve access to that unregulated market. Dodd has put together a draft that does a pretty good job of closing that up. And so it's a great start, but we have to understand that the lobbying influence of the banks and some of their clients has been enormous. They continue to have a lot of sway, maddeningly enough. This is an industry that has thrown hundreds of thousands of people out of work, led to people losing their jobs, their homes, and yet they continue to have a lot of sway on Capitol Hill. So for groups like Public Citizen, it remains a big fight to make sure that these derivatives markets are fully regulated, that all of the trading is done in a transparent exchange, fully under the control of a federal agency, whether that be the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Now, this is, I think, another one of these arcane points that needs to be drawn out a little bit for the general audience that may not be so familiar with it. But one of the proposals that people have made is to shift a lot of the trading of derivatives from custom things that banks devise with their customers that not even some of the people who sell these things fully understand, towards trading on regulated exchanges. You have standard contracts with lots of disclosure and none of these mysterious custom elements to them at all. How does
margin requirements, which is huge, a huge protection against systemic risk if you're having to put up collateral to make these bets.
So how do the House and Senate proposals stack up when it comes to shifting things onto the exchanges?
Well, there's some glaring differences. I mean, the House version allows end users to qualify for an exemption to preserve their access to an unregulated market. And the problem is that a lot of the banks are going to be able to successfully classify themselves as an end user. So it for all intents and purposes, retains access to the same kinds of unregulated markets that AIG, Enron, long-term capital management, the list goes on and on of big problems in the unregulated derivatives market that ended up coming up and biting consumers, taxpayers, shareholders hard. The Dodd bill closes a lot of those loopholes. It provides an exemption for a couple of specific types of products, foreign exchange trades, which is something that the Treasury Department has been pushing. But it it does a very good job of forcing all of this unregulated, dangerous, risky activity into a fully regulated market, which is what we want, because, you know, the Wall Street proved to the American people that they don't have credibility, that they can't be trusted to manage their own risks without needing significant taxpayer assistance to step in when they failed. So right now, I mean, bottom line is that the House bill does not satisfy the basic test of the kinds of re-regulation that we need. It's great to see that Senator Dodd has responded to requests by Public Citizen and Americans for Financial Reform and others, but we have to understand that you know, for all the listeners out there, that this battle is just beginning. Dodd's draft is good, but it's going to come under attack by the banks, and it's important that listeners out there are engaged, get in touch with your senators and demand, you know, full regulation over all aspects of Wall Street, because, you know, the price is just too high to get it wrong again.
Any sense of what's gotten into Dodd? I mean, he is the senator that represents the insurance industry and much of the hedge fund industry headquartered in Greenwich. Is it because he's facing a tough re-election campaign?
Well, I do think that that elections matter, that having to face your constituents on a regular basis sometimes requires politicians to pander to actual working people. And I think not to pat ourselves on the back, but, you know, we at Public Citizen and Americans for Financial Reform definitely aggressively met with Dodd's staff and said, look, you need to have some leadership here. The American people are counting on you. And, you know, we're working, you know, we're a big consumer group. We're working with organized labor. We're working with faith groups, other consumer groups. We have a broad-based coalition. And and I think that our message was received loud and clear. And, you know, we're going to continue giving that message to all 100 senators. But it's always helpful for all the listeners out there to get engaged. Develop a relationship with your member of Congress by calling them and demanding that they support the kind of strong regulations that Dodd has put forward. And, you know, don't erode this strong legislation. Don't allow Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan to weasel loopholes in there that will put the entire system and taxpayers at risk again.
That's the voice of Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen, and he's also joined on the phone by his colleague at Public Citizen, David Arkush. David Arkush, what's the timeline in these bills? Are we still in the early phases of all this?
It is still early. I mean, the bill is, all these reform bills are getting treated differently in the House, in the committee. This is the House Financial Services Committee. They're marking them up one at a time, and they haven't actually completed. They've got one last bill to finish marking up, and that's the bill on systemic risk. The prediction is that will be done sometime next week, and this will go to the floor in early December as one package. In the Senate, we haven't even started the committee process yet. Now, that's going to go fairly quickly, one hopes end, you know, by early December, and with some hope of taking a bill to the Senate floor shortly thereafter as well. You know, the president has said he wants to get this package done by the end of the year, and the House leadership and Barney Frank have said that they want to do that, and the Senate leadership and Senator Dodd have said they want to do it too. You know, the Senate's running on a pretty tight schedule at this point with healthcare still open and that sort of thing. But yes, we're certainly still in the early phases. I mean, it's hard to believe that we're, you know, over a year since the beginning of this crisis now, and no major reform legislation has passed yet, and we're still in some ways at the beginning of the process.
It looks in many ways like the economy is stabilizing, if not recovering. The financial markets have stabilized and even rallied. So is this change in the economic and financial landscape having any influence on the urgency of these reform efforts?
Well, there is a concern there because, you know, there's a really high percentage of millionaires in Congress, much higher than in the American public, and there's a really high percentage of wealthy people among lobbyists and the corporate lobbyists and the people they represent, and so there's a huge disconnect, right? You get the stock market recovering, and you get a lot of people feeling like the economy is doing better, and that is just totally distant from what, you know, the average American is feeling, with unemployment reaching, you know, its highest level since the early 80s. Really, no, you know, few, if any, signs of recovery to most Americans. And so there is a bit of a concern that as, you know, as the environment sort of appears to improve to some people, and those people are much better represented in Congress, that the reform efforts will lose a little bit of their urgency. And so that's one of the most, that's one of the biggest reasons why, you know, people really need to keep the pressure on. That's why, you know, sort of your listeners need to be calling their members, as Tyson was saying, why groups like us, Public Citizen and our coalition partners and Americans for Financial Reform just really need to keep the pressure up and keep the grassroots pressure up.
There are also a couple of other related bills floating around. One is Ron Paul's to audit the Fed, which seems like not a bad idea. They want to know where all the money is going, and the Fed doesn't like that idea. What's happening with that? Do you know?
It's unclear. It has a huge, huge sponsorship. It's wildly popular, and this is one of those really interesting issues. I mean, the Fed reform is one where you get much more bipartisan agreement than you would usually expect. You've got a lot of
it. Well, especially from the extremes, right? It's not the folks in the middle are less enthusiastic.
That's absolutely right. Although in the House, I think that they've got, you know, in the high 200s of co-sponsors on this bill, and you can't really get. It's hard to get that high without getting some people who are in the center. And it's the same thing in the Senate. You've got, you know, a lot of support for looking at the Fed very carefully and reforming it, doing some real governance reform, increasing, you know, putting some real transparency there, because the Fed occupies this really strange place in our government structure. It's not really part of the government. It's not really a fully private corporation. It has vast powers that, you know, are, you know, not subject to much public scrutiny at all and not much public accountability at all, and that's a serious problem.
Well, and they're spending trillions of dollars on various financial bailout schemes, and nobody really knows where the money has gone or to whom.
That's absolutely right.
Which is remarkable, and they don't want to tell.
That's right.
And then I think there's another bill that Bernie Sanders has introduced to, but that says basically if you're too big to fail, you're too big to exist, so you get broken up. What's happening with that?
Well, it's interesting. He just dropped the bill, and it sort of remains to be seen where that's going to go and who's going to sign on. But what's really interesting about that bill is it calls out one of the key flaws in the legislation that's been put forward. Now, the House legislation and the Senate legislation right now would at least grant authority to somebody to break up firms that get too big to fail, and to essentially to take failing firms and wind them down as opposed to bailing them out, there are also provisions that would give authority to a systemic risk regulator to increase the costs of getting big to try to avoid, you know, firms getting to that size, basically to ramp up regulatory requirements as firms increase in size, basically to make it so expensive that they might just not do it, or hopefully they won't do it. Now, the problem is, and this is what's really interesting and really just clever about Sanders' bill, is that all those authorities are just discretionary, right? So it's still going to be the regulator's choice whether to do this, and it you know, puts them in a position of being subject to political pressures, being subject to lobbying, being subject to the influence of big banks. And what would be much more useful would be objective standards that just say, you know, at X size limit, X regulations go into place, or at X size limit, you know, institutions are broken up. And that's what, you know, Bernie Sanders' bill basically just says, you know, create a list of institutions that are so big that if they failed, they would, put the entire system at risk and break them up.
Okay, I want to thank both of you for joining us. That was last voice was that of David Arkush, and before that, Tyson Slocum. And they're both with Public Citizen based in Washington, D.C., and thanks for all the great work both of you are doing.
You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News.
Okay, let's take a musical break, and we will be back to talk education with Monty Neal.
Make it all that noise.
And that was some of the Donnas doing Schools Out for the summer, the Alice Cooper classic. And now we're joined on the line by Monty Neal, who is with Fair Test up in Boston. And I don't think we're going to blow the schools to bits, as Alice and the Donnas would like to do, but we do want to talk about what is going on with the Obama administration and its relation to a lot of the Bush-era reforms of No Child Left Behind. Welcome, Monty Neal.
Thank you very much.
So the hook here is that the Obama administration, Education Secretary Arne Duncan, have released something called Race to the Top. What is the Race to the Top all about?
Well, the Race to the Top is one part of the stimulus funding package. That was $80 or $100 billion total to give to schools over 2 years. They allocated $4 or $5 billion, sort of a competitive grant program to states for their version of school reform. States will compete to it. The estimates most people have are maybe 12 or 15 states will get the money. They issued some draft guidelines or requirements, as they called it, a few months ago, and drew a firestorm of opposition. They just this morning released their final guidelines, and it seems to have quieted some of the opposition. They made a few concessions to reason, but I would say they did not go anywhere near far enough.
So let's get down to some of the specifics. They're still quite wedded to the whole model of testing, aren't they?
Yes. What they said in the guidelines, both originally and for the most part now still, is that, first of all, for any state to apply, it has to be able to use student assessment data to evaluate individual teachers. That is, link student test scores, because that's all there is for assessment data on a state level at this time, student test scores to individual teachers for the purposes of evaluation. Now, in the final guideline, that was one of the major objections that we at FairTest had and that many organizations, both teachers' unions and the board, the independent, the National Research Council, objected to that provision. And it was reduced so that out of 500 points that you can get for your grant, maximum points, 5 points can be awarded for actually using the test scores to evaluate teachers. So what they said is you can't have a firewall, but if you don't actually do it, that's okay. In practice, what's happened is a bunch of states that had that firewall have found a way to push legislation through real quick to get rid of it. The second thing they put a huge emphasis on is charter schools. They told states that they should drop the caps, if they have a cap, on the number of charter schools that they can have. In fact, what happened is that, like my state here in Massachusetts, they are in the midst of ramming through legislation real quick to accomplish that task. A number of states have already done it. California has been a little slower. It's actually been stalled in their legislature till January. When you look at the final guidelines, they don't give all that many points to charter kind of work either. So it appears that the union pressure has backed them off. Now, one of the issues with charter, let me, if you don't mind, take a minute to explain the problems with these two things.
Oh, absolutely.
The problem with the evaluating teachers based on test scores is the problem of the test. State standardized tests don't measure very much of what kids really need to know and be able to do. With the high stakes attached to them by the federal No Child Left Behind law, which is really, Race to the Top is really part of that law, the high stakes attached to that for schools and what many states did on their own, like high school graduation tests, what happens is that in the end, the test becomes the curriculum. Teachers narrow the curriculum to teach to what's on the test. Schools reduce their offerings in art, in phys ed, actually in science and history, because NCLB really only requires math and reading to count. So you have a narrowed curriculum in teaching to the test. What will happen with the Race to the Top teacher evaluation using those test scores, is there'll be even more pressure, if that's possible, to just teach the test because teachers don't want to get a bad evaluation based on it.
And despite this emphasis on testing, actual test scores haven't improved all that much, have they?
Well, it's been a funny story because if you look at the state scores, they look like they're going up a lot. I mean, New York's have gone through the roof. Everybody's now rapidly getting proficient. What's happened in New York is very clearly they've made the tests easier and they've lowered the definition of proficient. That is, you can get a lower score on an easier test and still be called proficient. So everybody looks like they're doing better. There are a set of federal tests, and they're only administered to samples of students, but they produce state-level scores and some city scores as well as national scores. They're called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP. And in fact, what's happened is the NAEP scores were actually going up faster in reading and in math before NCLB came into effect than after NCLB came into effect. All this massive teaching to basically low-level basic skills state tests have caused the score improvement on the somewhat better NAEP tests to slow down. And it slowed down even though the curriculum has been narrowed. So this law clearly has demonstrated by the most important measure that the law itself calls for, the NAEP scores, the law has been demonstrated to be a failure. This country cannot, test its way to better schools, but the NCLB illusion is that can happen, and race to the top perpetuates that illusion.
And a lot of other countries that score better than we do on international tests don't really emphasize testing so much in their curriculum, do they?
I think there's no country that tests as much as the U.S. I don't know of any country that requires testing in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school, which is what the U.S. does. Finland, which is now recognized as maybe having the best educational system in the world, and by the way, its population of students is 10% immigrant. There are several different major minority languages, and Finnish is a very difficult language. So we're not dealing with a place that's somehow so simple. Now, it is small. That's true. It's like a not-so-large state in the U.S., but it's outscoring everybody. It does have national standards, which for size would be somewhat comparable to state standards. They're fairly general. Their interpretation is essentially left up to schools and teachers. There is a little bit of sampling that goes on, and there's some college entrance exams, but otherwise they don't do any standardized testing. Testing or assessment is done by the teachers. The Finns believe that if you have high-quality teachers, the rest of the stuff takes, and you have social supports, well-funded schools, medical care for all, housing for all, et cetera, that then the learning, as it were, largely takes care of itself. The kids get engaged, the kids learn, the teachers know what they're doing, the kids don't come to school with toothaches or wonder where they're going to sleep at night.
Well, I do wonder, how much of our problem with education in this country is not the result of the schools, but the result of the fact that this culture is so brutal and anti-intellectual. Are the schools and the results just reflecting that?
Well, I think the school results reflect several things. They reflect, first of all, and most powerfully, the history of racism and the extremely unequal distribution of wealth and income in this country. This country increasingly looks like Brazil. It does not look like Western Europe. And the gaps between the wealthy and the poor are enormous, and the amount of, capital, you might call it, as it were, the wealth that individual families have, the gaps are enormous, far greater than in the countries that do better than the United States. So that well-to-do kids in the United States do very fine on international assessment stuff. Poor kids in the U.S., in Washington, D.C., and Mississippi, they look like they're in Lebanon, which has had, several major wars in the last 20 years. So, the inequality and that families have, the income instability, the lack of health care, the housing instability, the lack of good nutrition, all that stuff powerfully affects kids both before they get to school and while they stay in school. Second, to some extent, I think this anti-intellectualism or a distrust of learning, quote-unquote book learning, certainly plays into schooling in some places. It probably contributes to the gaps we see between more well-to-do districts with a much larger portion of highly educated parents than in poor districts. But most parents want their kids to be well-educated. They would like their kids to be quite literate. They hope their kids go to college or have something comparable to that. So I'm not as persuaded that's a major problem. Where it plays out, ironically, might be in the willingness to accept standardized tests as the definition of being educated. People don't realize just how very little those tests measure and how fallible they are, and that if you're talking about your kid wanting to go to college, having them do a diet of test prep in the school is not going to prepare them for that. And that's where I think not realizing critical thinking and really digging into books or doing science experiments, those things are really essential. Now, I've been in, you know, low-income working-class communities, people of color and so on, and actually I find that most of them want those kind of things for their kids. They don't really know how to get them. They haven't experienced it themselves in schools. And then the kids go to school, if they're poor kids, rural and urban, they're typically in systems that are broke. They're getting more broke, but they're just not able to provide a good education for the kids. And then, of course, between the lack of resources for the schools and the poverty of the students and their families, the system ends up blaming the teachers.
Speaking with Bonnie Neal of Fair Test, based in Boston, and you mentioned charter schools earlier, and of course the frustrations of many low-income parents leading them to turn to charter schools as some sort of salvation. What's your opinion of the charter school movement?
Well, I will say that Fair Test has no particular position on it. I do follow the research evidence on it to some degree. In principle, the idea that there ought to be a variety of kinds of schools that parents and kids can pick for their kids, where you're in an area where that's possible. Obviously, in rural areas, that might not be possible. In cities, it certainly is. I think it's actually a pretty good idea. Kids have different interests, different talents, and so on, as do their families. And so if they're all good schools, that can be a good idea. The notion of the charter as a panacea, however, seems to be deeply flawed. The data shows that in general and on average, charters perform equally to slightly less well than the regular schools they're presumably replacing. That is, some of the charter schools, of course, are great, and they're better than what they're replacing. More of them appear to be worse than better, and the bulk of them appear to be kind of about the same. So there seems little point in creating schools that are also test prep programs that aren't doing any better than the current public schools, and siphon a whole lot of money to the private sphere. I get it. I understand that parents are unhappy and want to move, and I'll be perfectly candid. When my son was in Boston and things were not going well in the school he was in, first we put him in a private school for a little while, and then we moved to the suburbs. And we were able to do that. We had some family money we could access, and we could do that. A lot of people simply can't do that. So my goal here is not to deny people opportunities, but to put up a big caution that what presents itself as an opportunity may not be an opportunity for your child. But on top of that, the process may be dismantling one of the last major really public spaces we even have in this country, which is public schools, and a kind of notion that not only are we going to have in this country a market economy, but we're going to have a whole market of society in which everything is for sale.
Well, you'd almost suspect that is what a lot of the policymakers and politicians are aiming to do, because, you know, as you point out, the research evidence in charter schools is, you know, at best ambiguous. But that hasn't dulled their passion for charter schools at all.
Well, what we're seeing is, in essence, that ideology is trumping evidence. It's true about high-stakes testing. It's true about privatization and charter schools. There's zero evidence that evaluating teachers based on kids' test scores will actually improve anything. Attaching high stakes to those kind of measures for teachers based on evidence from fields outside of education and in education in this country and internationally suggests it will actually make things worse, not better. There's a big part of Race to the Top that is about so-called school turnarounds, and they're talking about firing teachers and bringing in new teachers or making them charter schools, for example. And yet there's no evidence that those will actually work. I get that this country needs to figure out ways to improve schools that aren't doing well. There's a really crying need to do that. But when you start mandating a bunch of solutions that either have no evidence or are shown to be bad solutions on the grounds of ideology, contrary to the evidence, then you're just pushing the education system deeper and deeper into disaster. That's what the Bush administration does and did, and unfortunately, it appears to a great extent that's what the Obama administration with Secretary Duncan is now doing.
Any theory why Obama's people seem to be following in Bush's footsteps so precisely?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, this is hugely an agenda that comes from business groups. You know, the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, they've concocted lots of this stuff. They love the privatization. In Chicago, the key business group promoted what they call Renaissance 2010, which uses high-stakes tests to close schools, and then they're creating a lot of privatized thingies, little charters, and so on. They did it when Arne Duncan was there. They've turned around and bashed Arne Duncan because it didn't work well, but in fact, the business groups pushed it, and, you know, they kind of largely designed it and pushed it on the system, and Daley bought it, and Duncan carried out the orders. So I think there is a huge business push. There's not enough pushback, unfortunately, at this point from education and civil rights groups. There is some, but the sort of ethos of the business approach seems to run fairly dominant in the people that Obama has picked to be in the education field. I mean, he picked, I guess he wanted some cabinet officer from Chicago, and he picked education, unfortunately, for the students and teachers.
You have some stuff on your website. I was looking at some of the background papers about how it's a misnomer to talk about the achievement gap, which is one of the things that education reformers are obsessed with. Tell us about what that achievement gap is and what's wrong with the concept.
Yeah, our website, by the way, is www.fairtest.org. We have fact sheets, a newsletter, links to lots of stuff, and research papers. You know, I really borrowed this, what's on there from me, I really borrowed this. Of course, I'm not going to remember her name. Gloria Ladson Billings from University of Wisconsin-Madison, wonderful thinker. She talks about the education debt, and that what she says essentially is that the history of slavery and racism and segregation against not only African Americans but Native Americans and reservations and Latinos, coupled with the enforced poverty and lack of opportunity, has created this enormous debt. And that we talk about an achievement gap in ways that avoids confronting the actual debt. And this country ought to think about how it pays the debt to the people on whose backs the wealth of this country was largely built, but who are never able to equally share in that wealth or reasonably share in that wealth. And that's by racial groups, but also by class. And so, you know, the discussion of the achievement gap, I think, as she presents it, and I would agree if I understand her right, is an avoidance issue. It narrows it to schools and then narrows it further to test scores. So the other part of that we develop is that to talk about an achievement gap only based on test scores is to talk about unequal outcomes on a very limited set of measures. Even if you can somewhat boost the test scores, they're not actually going to tell you very much about what kids need to succeed in college or in life or in a job or as citizens to be effective jurors and so on and so forth, because that's so much more than is measured with standardized tests. By narrowing the curriculum, especially for poor kids, they're going to get even less of all these other things they actually need to succeed later on. And so we have an illusion as the test scores go up on state scores, and even on the state scores, in some cases, the gap appears to close, which is not on the federal tests, really. But as the gap may appear to close, the reality behind it is that it may be getting worse because of all the things that are important, that are unequally provided, and that aren't measured.
Yeah, I think far more important for educational outcome than what happens within the schools is what kinds of family backgrounds people have. Isn't that really a dominant influence?
Well, the research data shows that the overwhelming factor is that family background, basically socioeconomic class, predicts, you know, test scores and school outcomes. You want to predict test scores, look at zip codes. I mean, all those kinds of things are basically true. It is true that schools can add a whole lot and do a whole lot. So this is not an argument that schools don't matter for what kids learn. In fact, and they may matter more for kids whose parents aren't well-educated, because the well-educated, low-income parents may have the best of intentions, but they don't necessarily have the knowledge or of what it takes to succeed in a formal academic learning environment, which more formally educated parents, they already know that, and they can pass it on to their kids. So schools may be, in a certain sense, more necessary for those kids, for those kids, and yet the schools that they go to typically have less and therefore can provide less help. So it's a mix of the lack of the poverty in the community, in some communities, the lack of resources, and, you know, the kids growing up in poor communities get test prep, aren't going to make it in college, are going to end up in low-wage jobs, and their kids are going to be in poor communities doing low-wage jobs. And the irony in this country is that it pretends that it is that provides the most opportunity for climbing up the ladder of any country in the world, and the data I have seen in the last few years comparing the U.S., say, with Western Europe is that Western Europe is a much more openly, upwardly mobile, flexible society than the U.S. now is.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. The comparative income data and all that sort of thing show that there's more mobility in Western Europe than there is in the United States, although we think quite the opposite as part of our national faith. And finally, one of the favorite things that the business-driven education reformers like is talked about this already some, the more tougher teacher evaluations based on outcomes, but also more use of merit pay and, you know, more carrot and stick application towards the teachers. What do you think of these kinds of proposals?
Well, the worst part of it would be payments strictly on the basis of the student test scores. They're terrible proposals. One, they increase the teaching to the test. Two, they just create hideous backwash. I mean, this kind of stuff has been tried in other industries. By and large, it's failed. It's not actually used much even in the United States in industries outside of, you know, selling stocks and real estate, which we know what's happened with all the merit pay, so-called, in those fields. They've led to an economic disaster. You know, we'll get an educational disaster if we focus too much on so-called merit pay. It is true that this part of it appears to have been largely, you know, at least cut way back, if not largely eliminated, in the point system in Race to the Top. So I think this is, you know, I want to say that, you know, the uproar and the pressure against Race to the Top did win some things, not enough, but it won some things. So the answer is not to, you know, throw up our hands and say we can't do anything. The answer is, you know, people need to put a lot more pressure on Arne Duncan, the Education Department, on President Obama, on their members of Congress, get any organizations they're a part of from their church and temple onto their union or, you know, community groups and so on, business groups. They're part of the Chamber of Commerce. Tell the Chamber of Commerce to wake up and stop doing this stuff. There's lots of pressure points, but people have to be willing to apply them.
All right. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Monty Neal, who is with Fair Test, based in Boston, and that website, the Fair Test. Lots of information there on educational reform and many other things is fairtest.org, fairtest.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week. And let's go out with this. I played this a few months ago, but I'll play it again. Fisher Spooner, Supply and Demand. Till next week. Bye. Typical.